Time to take a look at the world of science with Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, William T. Evu Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA. Hi, everybody. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. And certainly, if you have some questions as we visit today with Bassam, you're most welcome to join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Bassam, welcome back.
Happy to be here, Larry.
And on this beautiful day when we've, as we were talking before the show, this is the, there's a big event happening today.
Big event tonight at 7:07 Central Daylight Time all over the world, actually. We will welcome spring all over the world in the Northern Hemisphere, that is. Mm-hmm. In the Southern Hemisphere, our fellow inhabitants of the globe will be welcoming what? Fall.
Fall.
It'll be fall. It's a, so it's that time of the year. It's the vernal equinox. And it is always exciting to me because I like to engage not only my students in the classroom, as I will today, tomorrow, mm-hmm. but others to think about why we have four seasons mm-hmm. and what causes the transitions from one season to another. But it is really exciting, and it is the beginning of spring, 7:07 Central Daylight Time tonight.
And we just saw the last week, actually, the conclusion of the Intel Talent Search and the Badger State Science and Engineering Fair in Milwaukee. And they're not basketball tournaments, but they're important, aren't they, science fairs?
I think they're very important. I think participation is key. Sometimes in fairs, competition is emphasized. And I just like to say very clearly that science fairs are not really about competition. There is an element of competition in there, mm-hmm. but they're about participation. The important thing is to participate. The joy and fun of participation is really, really enormous. And it is important for students, for teachers, for parents, to really think about projects that they might want to present at a school science fair or a regional science fair or a state science fair or the Intel Science. The Intel Corporation, some years ago, about 10 years ago, picked up the old Westinghouse Science Talent mm-hmm. search. And Larry, do you know how many people around the country participate in the Intel Science?
I have no idea.
1,700 people. Mm. 1,700 students. That is, in my estimation, way too low.
Yeah, it should be. I would have guessed into the thousands.
Well.
More thousands.
Yes, more thousands. And there are other science fairs. So the key is participation. Because in science, of course, there's no doubt about it. We have scientists and groups of scientists competing with each other to be first in a certain area or to discover something before somebody else discovers it. But truly, if you talk to scientists, you know that science makes progress through collaboration, not through competition, through collaboration. Competition is a natural human trait, and I'm for it, but I'd like to put it in perspective. So science fairs and participation in science activities, like science expeditions this weekend, you mentioned that. It's coming up at UW-Madison campus here on Saturday. There's a website, you know, that promotes it, and I'll put it on my website also after the program this morning. But participation, learning by doing, it's a hands-on, minds-on. It's not just a technician, you know, moving, mixing chemicals together and pushing buttons.
It's
really
wonderful.
Thinking about becoming engaged is what science fairs and science expeditions and next month Engineering Expo is coming up at UW-Madison. Mm-hmm. All kinds of activities that really attempt to engage youngsters and their parents and their grandparents, their guardians. I think participation is the key. And if somebody wins a contest that's being run along the same time, that's fine. But, you know, they're going to be more winners in the long run through more participation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the science expeditions this weekend, boy, if you're in the Madison area, a great place for families to go. There's so much hands-on materials, and I think some of your group will be involved in that as well, won't
they? Of course. We're always excited about participating in this. You know, we practice what we preach. We have fun doing this. We're going to have – I have a group of students who've actually take a course in learning not only the science that's presented but how to present it. So they'll be doing a public presentation, but we also have hands-on stations. And not only my group, but many other groups from the campus are putting on this excellent program called Science Expeditions, and it is for kids, for parents of kids, for guardians, grandparents. Everybody in the community is welcome. And you know what, Larry? It's free.
It's free, I know. And my wife would shoot me if I didn't mention it, because she's been heavily involved in some of the planning and so forth for it. And she'll be there, and I'll certainly be there as well in the afternoon with daughter Emily, and we'll be looking at all the fun things to do. It's a great experience. And go online to University of Wisconsin Science Expeditions, and you'll find it in the search engine. Or you'll put it up on your website, too?
We'll put it up, yeah.
At www.scifun.org.
Exactly, scifun.org.
And if you want to join in with a question for Bassam, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Mike in Madison's online, so let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm interested in the development of fullerene and its applications, and I know there's been a problem with mass production of it, all the different fullerenes, but... I'm wondering where we're at on that. Are we close to any practical applications on this substance?
Very good question, Mike. There's a lot of research going on, not only here at UW-Madison, but elsewhere around the country, around the globe, I would say, on development of practical applications for the use of fullerenes. Fullerenes are carbon. Carbon has three forms. Everybody knows very well about two of them, graphite and diamond. But in 1985, scientists discovered a third form of carbon called buckyballs, named after Buckminster Fuller. Mm-hmm. And that's why the name fullerene comes from. These are 60 carbon atoms bonded together. And there are many practical applications in terms of using nanotubes and using... making these nanotubes for delivery, for example, of drugs to certain locations in the body and so on. So, yes, Mike, there is a lot of research going on. And part of this research involves making sure that the practical applications are safe. Mm-hmm. They're not causing, you know, new hazards or potential hazards. So I think, you know, every day we get closer to hearing about important applications in industry, in health-related areas, in manufacturing that have to do with fullerenes.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Mike. Appreciate your call. And there is quite a bit of research going on, and actually, again, in several departments across the campus on this very topic. Let's talk about global climate. For just a minute, here we've got spring. Another season comes by, and the global climate debate is kind of heated up. I think that many people have come forth with suggestions on how to fix the problems leading to global warming. But you have some questions about whether or not science is being left out of the equation, as I understand it. How so?
Well, you know, the debate, and I think it should be a healthy debate. It's not always a healthy debate about global warming. It wasn't actually all that long ago when people in the scientific community were saying, well, global warming, what's that? You know, there's scientific uncertainty, quote unquote, about it. I think if you talk to anyone now who is informed, you quickly come to the conclusion that global warming is real. The debate about how to control the contributions that humans make to the environment that causes more global warming is what is, I think, is missing some of the real science. So I think we need to realize that since the Industrial Revolution, since we and our parents, grandparents, great grandparents started using fossil fuels, we have increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And this carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It's not the only greenhouse gas. And it contributes to keeping the heat radiation near the surface of the globe. By the way, Larry, greenhouse gases serve a useful purposes. If it weren't for greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, then the Earth will be very cold because the heat will escape. The question is, how much more are we adding? How much more carbon dioxide and other gases are we adding, but especially carbon dioxide? Carbon dioxide, in my opinion, is the culprit, and it comes from the combustion of fossil fuels, gasoline, specifically gasoline, but other petroleum products. When they're burned, they produce carbon dioxide, and scientists have tracked the amounts of carbon dioxide that are in the atmosphere for many years, and there's no question that there is a direct correlation between the amount of carbon dioxide, the increase in the amount of carbon dioxide, and the increase in the temperature, the ambient temperature. This has many, many serious consequences. The consequences affect the climate. For example, you know, how hot or how cold it is during the year, how dry or how humid is an environment. Do we have big snow blizzards, or do we have big downpours, or do we have droughts? All kinds of factors are being looked at very carefully by scientists because there seems to be a direct correlation between effects of increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and what happens on the surface of the planet. So carbon dioxide in the air, you know, through photosynthesis is the photosynthetic process in the leaves and plants is converted back to carbohydrates and so on. So
sugars.
So there's a natural amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There's no question about that. But it's the increase of CO2 emissions due to our heavy use of fossil fuels is really the culprit. And that's something that is not much under debate anymore in the scientific community. What is missing from the public debate is being informed about the science behind the statements that are being made. And there are accusations among public officials who say that a certain government agency is sometimes suppressing information about global warming or wanting not to release data that have been accumulated. And that's even in today's morning paper, you know, I read about a story about a White House official who no longer works at the White House who was suppressing information about global warming. So I think it's very important to understand what the science is, and then we have to decide what to do about it. And we have to think about alternatives to our heavy dependence on fossil fuels in order to satisfy our energy needs.
Bassam Shakashiri, our guest today, talking science, all kinds of science with him today. He's UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And if you have a question for Bassam Shakashiri in the science research area, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. We'd love to hear from you. And let's take a call. David in Appleton, you are next. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I have two questions. One, I'm just curious in relation to the carbon dioxide put off by cars and things here on the ground versus what planes put out, seeing as how it seems like they'd be a little better delivery system, a little closer to where the problem is. Just curious on the difference there, and then I was also curious about if we weren't giving off all these emissions, would it warm up anyways? Are we just hurrying it along with these emissions, or does the Earth kind of have a cycle that it warms and cools on its own?
Mm-hmm. There is a natural cycle for the Earth as it warms up and cools off. What human beings are doing now, as we satisfy our needs, energy needs, we're burning a lot of fossil fuels in a variety of forms. And these fossil fuels, the combustion of a fossil fuel gives you carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is increasing in the atmosphere more so than the natural concentration. And these increases of carbon dioxide and a few other greenhouse gases, but carbon dioxide is the major culprit here. What causes puts the use a metaphor here puts like a shield that traps the heat that comes off. It's a radiation from the sun hits the surface of the Earth and then it bounces back, and some of it escapes, but the heat part, the infrared part, does not escape. It's kept in near the surface of the Earth, and so. Because of the carbon dioxide that's in there and the other greenhouses. And so we have increased the amount of carbon dioxide. At the same time, you know, we've cut down rainforests and other trees that used to consume carbon dioxide through photosynthesis. So the increases are due to our advances in science and technology. Let me put it this way. We've learned a lot about how to develop engines that give us energy for transportation and home heating and for generating electricity. All of these are very good, very good. But we need to think about the consequences of the increase in the CO2 and the carbon dioxide emission. Now, you mentioned something, David, about the first
cars point. Versus planes in terms of the amount of carbon dioxide and pollution that they might.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a lot more cars than there are planes, but planes also. Any combustion process gives off unburned hydrocarbons, the fuel, but also a lot of carbon dioxide. So the amount of carbon dioxide near the surface of the Earth is what we're talking about here. It doesn't go all the way up to the stratosphere. It doesn't. It just sticks around. As I said earlier, it's a good thing because we need greenhouse gases. Otherwise, you know, the Earth would cool off very rapidly, and we would not know life as we have it now. Life would not exist as we know it now, if it weren't for the right balance between the amounts of such gases in the atmosphere and radiation that hits the surface of the planet.
Hmm. Thanks, David. Dolly in Madison, it's your turn now. Hi, Dolly. Dolly, are you there? Oops. No, we lost Dolly, I guess. Let's go to Jim in Minocqua. Let's try Jim. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just have a comment. Well, it's kind of a question, too. But a few years ago, I read in Scientific American that Mexican volcano put more pollution up in 1 hour than man has since he's been on the face of the planet. And there's also 250 other active volcanoes around the world. And to me, this is science, and I don't hear any proponents for greenhouse warming, you know, addressing this at all.
That's a good point, Jim. There are natural events, including eruptions of volcanoes, that contribute to pollution. There's no question about that. They are factored into this balance that scientists study about the presence of these gases and these pollutants, as you correctly put them, in the atmosphere and their effect on the planet. So there's a natural cycle that the planet undergoes, and through science and through technology, we're learning more about it. The point that I'm trying to make here is that our heavy dependence as human beings on fossil fuels as a source of energy has resulted in increasing the amount of carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere. Now, we can do some things. I hope we can do some things about our use of fossil fuels for energy purposes. We cannot do anything about volcanoes erupting here and there. Well, we can try to stay away from them, but we cannot stop them. So there are human activities that are contributing greatly to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air beyond the ability of the planet to adjust to it naturally.
And thanks very much for calling, Jim. And Anne in Madison will give you a chance now. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I wondered if Dr. Shakashiri would comment on the continuing use of chlorine gas and chlorine, especially in its undiluted form in the United States. It's on the EPA extremely hazardous substances list. It's the common link in some of the most dangerous environmental poisons existing, like dioxin, Agent Orange, DDT, PCBs, and chlorofluorocarbons. It's being, it has been connected to a number of great health problems like bronchial problems, emphysema, gene damage, chromosome alteration, which can produce biological mutation. Yet it seems to be, because it's so cheap, it's derived artificially from salt. It's used by industry in all kinds of situations here, while it's been banned from industrial use in Europe, and that was, I believe, beginning about 15 years ago. I wondered if you could comment on its effects and possible substitutes for chlorine that are also cheap, because cheapness is what industry is basically and essentially looking for.
I'd be happy to comment, Anne. Chlorine, the element chlorine, is a diatomic element. It has two chlorine atoms, so we're talking about Cl2. Yes, Cl2 is a very hazardous substance, and you won't find it around the house or in the supermarket or anywhere else. It is carefully manufactured and shipped. And it is, as Anne said, a very useful industrial chemical. It's a very useful industrial chemical, and it is used in making all kinds of plastics and polymers that we use on a daily basis. We don't even, you know, think about it. Polyvinyl chloride, PVC, for example, PVC pipes have chlorine in them. So the question that she's really asking, as I understand it, is, you know, how can we be sure that it's being safely handled?
And are there
other chemicals that we can substitute for using it? And so cost, as Anne correctly says, is an important factor industrially. And when I say industrially, I mean for our society. You know, we would like to have products that are useful and that we can afford, but I think they should be safe. So there are many research programs all over the world looking at finding alternative methods for manufacturing useful products that do not involve chlorine as such. There is something called the Chlorine Institute, which is really a trade group, and they have a website with information about chlorine and its uses. And they do support, in part, looking at alternatives for the use of chlorine. But I think, you know, the way I take Anne's question is that, you know, they have a lot of chemicals. We live in a chemical world, and we need to learn what the properties are and how we can use those chemicals safely and minimize the hazard. You know, every chemical is potentially hazardous. Water is hazardous. You can drown in water. Mm-hmm.
Somebody died from drinking too much of it in a contest here not too long ago.
Well, the human brain, you know, allows us to do things that we shouldn't do, and we should put some control on that. But you're right. So the point is about chemicals. You know, we are made of chemicals ourselves. We really need to understand and appreciate how we use those chemicals, whether it's chlorine or chromium or lead or any of the other elements that we hear about and any of the other chemical substances that we know about that we use. I mean, look, PVC is a water repellent. Raincoats are coated with PVC. Milk cartons are coated with PVC. So Anne is correct. There is great industrial demand for using chlorine to manufacture such products. And part of the research that goes on in science and in engineering and in technology is to find alternatives that would be less hazardous but equally useful and equally accessible.
No. Thanks, Ann, for calling. And Tom and Nina will give you a chance now. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm calling you from a cell phone. So I got two quick questions. I'm going to give them to you and then get off here because I might lose you anyways. First of all, I would like to ask, what could the average American family do to help stop producing greenhouse gases other than making your house as energy efficient as possible? And also, I had heard a study where they were talking about being able to reverse the effects of global warming by shooting particles up into the atmosphere, which would reflect the sunlight back off into space and cool the Earth. Have you heard anything about that, and would that really be such a good idea?
I haven't heard much about the second part of your comment and question, Tom. I haven't heard much about that, so I won't comment about that. There are always people making suggestions like that, and, you know, frankly, in science, we try to look at all kinds of possibilities. We try to ask questions that we can then formulate in such a way that we try to seek good answers to. But on your first question, really a very powerful question. What can we as individuals or as a family do to eventually reduce our production of carbon dioxide through the dependence on fossil fuels? Well, the very first thing, I think, and I really mean the very first thing, is to really understand what we are doing now and what the consequences are of what we're doing. Because we're just using enormous amounts of energy, mostly coming from fossil fuels. And so the first step is to become personally informed and knowledgeable, and to discuss it not only at home, but to discuss it at school, in the business community, discuss it in the local community where you live, so that we take collective public responsibility for looking at alternatives that may be available to give us the kinds of energy sources that we need. And they have to be available at an affordable price. So there's a lot of interplay here between results of scientific and technological advances and developments and affordability. But I think the average family, for example, instead of I really don't want to get too deep into this, but
right.
You know, if you have three cars and you're going to the same destination, maybe all five people can drive in the same car. Will that make a difference immediately in the emission of carbon dioxide? No, it will not. Will it make a difference in the attitude that the five people have? Of course it will. And if all of us become aware and become willing to understand the ramifications and the consequences of this huge issue that we face, global warming, the consequences, there'll be diseases that will develop because of drought and because of, in some parts of the world and other parts of the world, because of a lot of rain. If we can begin to learn about that, I think that I would be reasonably satisfied.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Tom. Appreciate your call. Bassam Shakashiri, our guest, talking science and science research with him. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Talking a pretty broad range of things today with him, and we certainly welcome your calls along the lines we've been discussing or other areas as well. Look forward to your calls. Ben and Merrill, you are next. Hi, Ben. Thanks for calling.
Hey. Sam, do you happen to know anything about magnetohydrodynamics and how that all worked out in California?
Hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics.
Tell me. Tell me about it.
Nothing.
Oh, you don't. Okay. Okay.
I thought you were trying to ask me a question about it, or...
Oh, yeah. Well, my question is, you know, magnetohydrodynamics is like generating electricity out of almost nothing. And physicists have been researching this since the $20 on a magnet on to do this in California somewhere, and I haven't heard anything about it.
I'm sorry, Ben. I haven't either. I'm sorry.
I wish we could help you out on that one, but I'm sorry we can't. Maybe somebody else knows about it. Sherry in Madison, your turn. Hi, Sherry.
Hi, Larry. This is Sherry Gruder calling, and I work in sustainable design and renewable energy, and I just wanted to offer some suggestions. The caller asked, what can people do personally to improve their carbon emissions footprint? And I would like to suggest that they can improve the energy efficiency of their homes. They can have an Energy Star assessment done and improve how they use energy in their homes. They can install renewable energy, both solar energy and solar electric and solar thermal, solar hot water heat. They can, and there are rebates through Focus on Energy for that. They can buy renewable energy from their utility.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of utilities have plans that you can sign up for. And in the Madison area, MG&E is getting more renewable energy at the end of the year, and so they'll be opening it up. And we're going to have a challenge to the citizens or the residents of the area to purchase that renewable energy. And also people can drive hybrids and hybrid electric cars and use vegetable oils and biofuels in their cars and stop driving their cars and switch to alternative transportation, whether it be public transportation or bicycles or walking or ride sharing.
Sherry's been a guest on my program many times, and those are all good tips, I think.
Very good tips, yes. And what Sherry's really talking about is acting on the knowledge that one acquires once we realize that there's a problem or a set of complex problems that we have to face here. And, you know, essentially, we have to look at our lifestyles and how we and what we do and how we do it. And all the suggestions that she mentioned are worth considering and acting on. And, you know, eventually it'll end up being an economic question. You know, is it more affordable? Is it practical to do it this way? Can we as a society, not just as individuals, but as communities in the Madison area or in the state of Wisconsin or in the upper Midwest, really act in responsible ways to demand from our government and from our utility companies that we have affordable energy sources so that we get to enjoy the environment that we live in. We get to enjoy the communities that we live in.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Sherry. Appreciate it. Thank you. Suzanne in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, good afternoon. I guess it's almost afternoon. I was wondering if your guest was familiar with any studies that are being done or have been done to look at the increase in energy consumption because of our increase in computer technology. Because I know that as we install bigger and faster computers, we're demanding much more energy. Even in the last 5 years, I think we've probably doubled on the floor how much energy you need to run some of these computers.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you'd heard any research on that.
Yeah, good question, too.
Very good question. You know, the more human beings excel in developing new products, new advances, new technologies, the more our energy demands go up. And so you're right that our thirst for energy in the form of electricity, that's what you're talking about now, is up. And there's a lot of research going on to look at alternatives of sources of energy. You hear about the hydrogen economy, using hydrogen, the combustion of hydrogen, safe combustion of hydrogen as a source of energy. Yes, there are technological pursuits along these lines. Are they yet affordable in the marketplace? Not quite. But take a look at hybrid automobiles right now. Mm-hmm. You know, 25, 30 years ago, They were just a curiosity thing in terms of the research that was going on. Now we see them driving on the highway. So I would say what I said earlier. I think understanding what the issues are and then being careful in demanding from ourselves, from our utility companies, from our society, from our fellow citizens, from our government, demanding safe and good sources of energy. I think that's the right way to go.
And thanks very much, Suzanne. Appreciate it. Leroy in Livingston, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest about liquefying coal. I understand we've got hundreds of years of coal out west. Is the technology there, and what are the advantages and disadvantages of this?
I think there is sufficient technology to do that and to even gasify coal, not just to liquefy it. But again, the combustion products will include carbon dioxide. And so that's a question that we really have to look at in terms of affordability of the gasification and or the liquefaction process of coal. But then we need to be concerned about what is being emitted and the consequences of contributing to increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air.
Would the carbon dioxide be more from coal and from other sources that we have?
Coal is mostly carbon. So when you burn carbon, you get carbon dioxide. If you burn carbon with enough oxygen, you get carbon dioxide. If you burn it with not enough oxygen, you get the poisonous gas carbon monoxide. You don't want that. That's
no.
Deadly poisonous.
No, you definitely don't want that.
Right.
Thank you very much for calling, Leroy. I appreciate your call. And Bassam, as always, thank you so much for coming by. As always, I want to remind people to take a look at your website because you have so many things on that website, www.scifun.org, S-C-I-F-U-N.
Scifun.org, and I'm going to post a link to an excellent presentation that was made by the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science on the very same topic that we spent most of the time on this morning, Larry. It's an outstanding talk that he gave. And people can listen to it or watch the slides that he used. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you very much, Bassam. Appreciate it. Bassam Shakashiri, UW-Madison Professor of Chemistry, and William T. Evu, Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin Idea. Always fun to have him on, and he'll be back again, and we'll talk with him some more. Coming up, though, we're going to turn our attention to owls. Laura Erickson, our guest, coming up next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.